From NPR and WBUR, I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're going to convene our political strategist roundtable in a few minutes. What would they advise the president on answering Robert Mueller's questions? But first, a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say diseases caused by mosquito, tick, and flea bites more than tripled in the U.S. between 2004 and 2016. The study's lead author said the numbers of some diseases, including Lyme, West Nile, and Zika, have gone to astronomical levels. Dr. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. He wasn't involved in the study, but doctor, your thoughts on the results?
Well, thanks a lot for having me. And I think the Centers for Disease Control is absolutely right. We have seen a big increase in the number of what we call vector-borne diseases, or what they say, diseases transmitted by mosquitoes, ticks, and flea bites. And it's especially a problem down here in Texas. But I think it's also important to point out that the number they're talking about is probably a low-ball estimate, an underestimate, because a majority of the diseases transmitted by vectors, by mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, are actually either not reported or undiagnosed.
Well, so why do you think this is happening? The author, Dr. Lyle Peterson, who's the director of vector-borne diseases at the CDC, declined to link it to climate change. That's a politically fraught phrase for many in Washington right now. But warmth is mentioned as one of the reasons.
Well, so actually what we're seeing here in Texas and elsewhere, especially in the southern United States, is sort of a confluence or a perfect storm of a number of factors. They include poverty. They include shifts in human migrations and transportation. But there's no question that increasing temperatures, longer spring and summers, shorter winters, most likely attributed to climate change, is a huge factor.
Because we're seeing ticks thriving in areas that used to be too cold for them, and hot spells can launch mosquito-borne diseases. What are you seeing there in Texas that is alarming you?
The things that are alarming us are we're seeing, and some of them were barely even mentioned in the report, we're seeing a lot of transmission of a parasitic infection called Chagas disease, which is a parasite of the heart that causes debilitating heart disease and even sudden death. That's transmitted by kissing bugs. We're seeing...
Wait, a kissing bug. I'm sorry. What's a kissing bug?
A kissing bug is we call them reduvid bugs or triatomines. They actually feed on blood, and they're quite common down here in Texas and elsewhere in the southern United States. But then the big one, which again was barely mentioned in the report, is West Nile virus infection. We're seeing lots of deaths from encephalitis and other chronic renal disease from West Nile virus. So this is a serious issue and needs to be better prioritized by our public health agencies.
And how so? Because there's no vaccine to prevent, a mosquito bite. What is the prevention and what aren't you getting?
So here's what we're not getting. First of all, although the Centers for Disease Control can direct a lot of policy, a lot of the hands-on legwork to prevent these diseases is actually done by local, county, and state health departments, and they're terribly underfunded across the United States, especially in the southern U.S. So as a result, they cannot do what we call active surveillance, that is, go into communities and actually look for how many people are affected by either a tick-borne disease or a mosquito-borne disease. So that's a big problem. We also don't have adequate funding for much of the country to do vector control, that actually control these. And then you mentioned vaccines. You're absolutely right that we could develop vaccines for a number of these diseases. Our National School of Tropical Medicine is actually working to develop a West Nile virus vaccine and Chagas disease vaccine, but the funding is very meager. These diseases in the U.S. tend to fall through the cracks.
Well, you say you're seeing something new there. Some of the other 9 new germs spread by mosquitoes and ticks that have been discovered or just introduced, the Heartland and Bourbon viruses, is part of maybe the jump in the numbers that people maybe are going to get tested when they have symptoms they don't understand?
The other big problem that we're having is training of healthcare professionals. Many medical schools are not even teaching about these diseases. Nurses and nurse practitioners and other healthcare providers are not educated about these diseases. Very few physicians these days are going into infectious diseases anymore, in part because the salaries are quite low compared to other specialties. So this problem is going to get worse before it gets better.
Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, will link you to the CDC report on the increased number of diseases spread by mosquitoes, ticks, and fleas. Fleas! Plague. Dr. Hotez, thank you so much.
Okay, all the best.
Now to Washington, where the Federal Communications Commission is losing one of its two Democrats. There are three Republicans. Mignon Clyburn was appointed to the commission by President Obama in 2009, and she's been on the losing side of a number of battles in recent months at the Republican-controlled FCC. Most notably, she opposed the FCC's moves to undo Obama-era net neutrality rules that were designed to prevent so-called internet fast lanes for some providers and the slowing or blocking of content for others. Mignon Clyburn joins us. And Commissioner, you're currently the longest-serving member on the FCC. Why are you stepping down now?
Why now? Because I think the time is right for me. I've spent nearly 9 years at the FCC. I've seen a lot of great policy decisions. I've been a part of enabling broadband connectivity all over this country, bringing awareness to those who are on the wrong side of the opportunities and technology and economic divide and how a connected America, what that could mean for them. I have done all that I know how to do to bring voice, to bring awareness to consumers' needs. And so I concluded that my effectiveness would be more so realized on the outside as opposed to staying at the commission.
You spent years helping to craft national net neutrality rules. Those rules are in the process of being dismantled by the Republican majority on the FCC. What's it like for you to see that happen?
It's disturbing. It took us years, and we used this inclusive, painstaking process in order to achieve the balance that looked out and took into account consumers' needs. And to see all of that being put at risk, it's painful. It was unnecessary.
Senate Democrats are preparing to force a procedural vote next week on restoring net neutrality rules. It's not expected to succeed, but what do you make of the fact that Congress is attempting to take up this issue?
They're listening to the citizens back home. More than 80% of them are in support of strong net neutrality principles. They're looking at those two states and more than 30 other states that are considering their own legislation. Six states have put executive orders in place. They say, if you do business in our state, you will abide by those net neutrality principles. They're listening to the will of the people because the federal government has punted. The federal government that when my parents were coming up, it was a positive backstop when it came to ensuring those opportunities and those freedoms. And state and local governments are the only backstops that people have now.
What's your response then to FCC Chair Ajit Pai, who says that loosening regulations on net neutrality is going to spur broadband in low-income areas, rural areas like Louisiana, where he was speaking this week?
Well, if he were to go to those communities and ask those individuals who their provider is, he would have heard that in at least half of those communities, there's only one option. And in some communities, there are no real options. Again, if you really tell and dissect and tell people exactly what the future holds for them, that a monopoly will be the gatekeeper potentially when it comes to the access over the internet, if he were to be transparent about what the future holds for them, I guarantee you he would not have gotten a great reception.
Phone rates in prisons was also an important issue for you. The FCC had capped the price of calls to inmates at $1 a minute. The FCC now under President Trump has changed course. How have people been impacted by that change?
They have seen their rates, particularly when it comes to intrastate rates, those rates that people are charged inside of the state, they've seen them go up. We made some initial strides, positive strides, with interstates, meaning calls between states. But what happened when we made that, commitment to rationalize, those rates in between states, what those companies did was shift the cost to that more unregulated infrastructure when it comes to intrastate rates. So what we're seeing is people are actually paying more to call loved ones inside of the states. And the FCC is silent, is sitting on its hands, and there is no agency that is stepping up to the plate.
Well, you've been credited as being a commissioner who looked out for the neglected. Who will pick up your mantle?
I am hoping my successor will. There are millions that are don't have broadband at home. There are millions who don't have a dial tone. I am hopeful that that individual will hear those voices and will be an advocate for change.
But without your voice on the commission, you've left that a bit up to chance.
Well, what was going to happen by the end of the year, as you know, Mina, I was going to have to leave. So my time of service was up. But look, I'm not going far. So while I won't have a vote, I will still have a voice, and you will hear it.
Mignon Clyburn, outgoing commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, thanks for talking with us.
It has been my pleasure.
More shuffling today in President Trump's legal team. Ty Cobb, the lawyer with the iconic name and bushy mustache, who is known for taking a cooperative approach with FBI investigators, is out. The New York Times is reporting Emmett Flood has replaced him. Flood advised Bill Clinton in his impeachment process, and his firm represented Hillary Clinton in the email controversy. He'll join the team determining how the president approaches the special counsel's Robert Mueller's Russia investigation.
Well, we've been learning more about that investigation this week. Former Trump lawyer John Dowd confirmed to the Associated Press that back in March, Mueller told him and the rest of Trump's legal team that Mueller could subpoena the president to force him to answer questions. And the Washington Post reported that it was Trump lawyer Jay Sokolow who, after the threat of a subpoena, compiled that list of 49 questions that Trump legal team thought Mueller might ask Trump. That list was leaked Monday night. So should Trump answer those questions? Let's bring in our political strategist, Paris Denard, the Republican strategist, a member of a Trump Advisory Commission. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Welcome to you, Jamal, as well.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, Paris, let's start with you. It's thought the leak of the questions came from someone outside Trump's team, but in his inner circle. Who would do that? Would you have advised that? And what would you advise the president to do now? You know, why not answer the questions if you think there's no collusion?
Well, I don't know who leaked the questions, but I think the president's tweets about it speak for themselves, how he did not think it was something that should have been done. Point two is that I think the president should not go before the investigators and testify, because I think that it just runs the risk of anything happening. And the president being asked a question and answer in a way that, look, I always tell people, I don't ask a question unless I know the answer. And I think that all of the questions that the Mueller team has put together, they know the answers to. And it's very easy to get somebody tripped up and have somebody go back years and years, because this is the last point. This is not just about the Russia investigation or the Russia collusion claim that I think is false. The president believes is a witch hunt. These questions, and I think the focus of it is far beyond, because special counsel has a very, very large and long scope that he can go down. And so it's going back for years of the president's finances and his business dealings and all that, those things. And so I think the best thing for the president to do is to give written responses back to the investigators, and not do hours and hours of just him talking to them at length.
Jamal, you respond to that.
Well, you know, Donald Trump has this cornucopia of nefarious characters that he hangs out with. I mean, this week we saw the reemergence of Dr. Harold Bornstein, who is really a character from, you know, a TV show, if you were trying to pitch it, who's been saying that the president's people came into his office and took the president's medical records, even snatched the president's pictures off the wall. These are the kinds of people who the president surrounds himself with. So whether it's Michael Cohen, it's Harold Bornstein, it's porn stars, it's Playboy bunnies. Yes, if I were working for Donald Trump, I wouldn't want him to testify either, because who knows who else he's in bed with and who knows what else he's done before he became president and since he's been in the White House.
Well, Jamal, I want to hear from you. There are legal questions over whether the president can be subpoenaed or indicted. What do you think Democrats should be doing? A CNN host said the other day that he was having a hard time booking Democratic lawmakers because the word had gone out, let the Republicans and the Mueller investigation take up the TV screens. Is that a good strategy?
So Democrats should be arguing that we want to hold Donald Trump accountable. What that means depends on what he's found guilty of. But we do want to hold him accountable. Democrats should also want to stand up for Democratic values of openness and honesty and opportunity and, you know, education, all those sort of things. And at the same time, Democrats need to offer a vision for the future about where it is they want to take the country. And I think if it's those three points, hold the president accountable, stand up for our values and have a vision for where we want to go as a country, I think Democrats will do just fine.
You know, Parrish, I just got to ask you a follow up here. We're going to move on to so much else. But if President Trump doesn't go before Mueller, doesn't he look weak?
No, he looks smart. Listen, this is I would not, if I was an attorney, I would advise my client not to go and testify. I could care less what he thinks or what my job is to advise him the best strategy from a legal perspective. And legally, it is easy for somebody to get to say something. And they think that they said something that's correct, and it just turns out not to be correct, or they just don't remember, and they say something inaccurately, and it comes out to be false. I can't tell you what I said yesterday. I can't tell you the last time I was on this program what I said. And if I said it under oath or if I was testifying in any particular manner, it would be held against me. So, no, he would not be seen as weak. He was seen as smart and listening to his counsel. Everyone says the president doesn't listen to people. In the moment when he might listen to somebody, now you want to say that he's weak. It's absurd. The president should listen to his counsel if they advise him not to testify.
Okay, well,
the president should listen to his counsel, but he should also tell the truth. And if he's telling the truth, he probably will remember what the facts are.
All right. So that debate is going to continue until it finally resolves and we figure out whether or not he is going to go and answer the questions. But I want to ask you about something the president was asked at a news conference on Monday. He was asked if he was worried that pulling out of President Obama's deal with Iran to denuclearize sends the wrong message to North Korea, which Trump wants to denuclearize. Here's the president's answer.
No, I think it sends the right message. You know, in 7 years, that deal will have expired and Iran is free to go ahead and create nuclear weapons. That's not acceptable. 7 years is tomorrow.
In Paris, you know, his critics say this is exactly the wrong message to send, what we're hearing out of the White House now and from Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, you know, get out of this deal. It's the wrong message to send to North Korea because they will look at that and say, why should we negotiate a deal? You're just going to break it.
Well, first of all, the president did not, this administration did not negotiate that deal. This was a deal that was, this horrible deal was negotiated and done by the Obama administration. And so what this tells North Korea is that the president is going to fight for the American people and he's going to stick to his guns. If he says that he's going to do something, he is going to do it and you better listen. And he's not going to enter into another bad deal. And so it tells North Korea, this president means what he says and says what he means. And so I think it's the right message to send to them.
Why is it a bad deal if there's no proof that North Korea has broken it?
North Korea or
I'm sorry, Iran has broken it.
Well, I think there's clear evidence, and I think Israel, the Prime Minister of Israel, he laid claim to this, and a lot of the things that many people have said for a very long time, looking at the lies that we think that are coming out of that regime.
But they were from 2003.
The lies that are coming out of that regime. And so you can say it was 2003. If we couldn't trust them in 2003, you certainly can't trust them now. And I think that there's a lot of credible people who are experts who say that this is a deal and the things that they're doing cannot be trusted to do the right thing and to denuclearize. They're not doing it.
Well, Robin, that's the whole point of the deal. The whole point of the deal
was to give them billions of dollars.
No, the point of the deal is that you can't trust Iran and you've got to have inspectors and you've got to have a regime that goes in place and verifies what they're doing. And if we pull out of the deal, it means we won't have that. As to North Korea, absolutely they are paying attention to what happens because who wants to do a deal with somebody who's not going to hold up the end of the deal he's doing with anybody else. But that's the fundamental problem with Donald Trump. He's a sham artist.
Well, but wait a minute.
The entire time Donald Trump has been in public life, he says one thing, and we find out those things are not true from the day he was inaugurated and he talked about the crowd size until today. And even his chief of staff calls him an idiot.
Jamal, should he get the Nobel Peace Prize?
That's not true. We weren't there, so don't say that.
Jamal, should he get the Nobel Peace Prize?
He shouldn't even get a picture of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh.
Listen, hold on a second, though. Paris, I'm rooting for Donald Trump to actually get the North Korea deal done because it's so important to me, my child, and all the rest of us.
Say
it's important for him to get it done. The problem is we can't trust a word that comes out of the president's mouth. So we need a lot of independent verification to make sure this is really happening.
Well, at an event at the museum yesterday, I want to ask you about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. He sidestepped most questions about the Russia investigation, which he oversees, but he did speak out against a move by some House Republicans to impeach him for failing to turn over documents about surveillance in the investigation.
Yeah, there have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time. And I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted. We're going to do what's required by the rule of law. And any kind of threats that anybody makes are not going to affect the way we do our job.
And President Trump tweeted this morning, they don't want to turn over documents to Congress. What are they afraid of? Why so much redacting? Why such unequal justice? At some point, I have no choice but to use the powers granted to the presidency and get involved. Paris, would you advise the president to get involved?
I would advise the president to continue to fight for what he believes to be right and to be just, and to push his Department of Justice to do the right thing. And it seems as that it's becoming more and more politicized, and that the resemblance of impropriety, the resemblance of anything that is sort of leaning against what is right and leaning against what a lot of people say is away from justice for President Trump or for the American people, if it looks political, it's not right, and the president should intervene.
I got to get one last question into Jamal. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told the Boston Globe today she's going to run for Speaker again. She believes Democrats will take back the House in the midterms. Jamal, is this the wrong, you got a few seconds here, wrong, right direction for your party?
Oh, I asked Nancy Pelosi this very same question for the interview I did for her for The Hill, and she told me, we have it on video, that she was not giving up her seat at the table. And I think that's exactly right, because she's the only woman right now in leadership, and Democrats can do far worse than having Nancy Pelosi at the table and making sure that she's holding the caucus together.
Well, Paris, quick, you got 2 seconds. Go.
They can do a lot better. When you talk about diversity and you would talk about things that you want to have, this is the symbol of the face of the party that you want. I think that's a bad idea.
Republicans talking about diversity. That's rich.
Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Paris Denard, the Republican. Thank you both, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Facebook will soon be a place you can find a date. CEO Mark Zuckerberg spoke at the network's annual F8 conference yesterday, and he said that Facebook will roll out a dating service aimed at building long-term relationships, not just hookups.
And I know a lot of you are going to have questions about this, so I want to be clear that we have designed this with privacy and safety in mind from the beginning. Your friends aren't going to see your profile. You're only going to be suggested people who are not your friends.
Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, first, tell us more about how this service will work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm laughing, and so was Zuckerberg when he said this. I mean, it seems to be part of Facebook's mission to make more meaningful connections. And by the way, keep us on Facebook for more and more time. I mean, from what he said, it seems like users would set up a dating profile that is opt-in, so it would not be automatically show up in your feed. It wouldn't be, as he said, visible to your friends or show up in your feed if you like somebody. And really, the focus seems to be not so much on who you know, but what you're interested in. So users would browse events and groups, and if they like it, then unlock that event to interact with others that are attending. And importantly, those conversations would also be separate from showing up on your Messenger or WhatsApp. So there'd be some degree of it hidden from the rest of the world in case you're doing something you don't want everybody else to know about. What we don't know, though, is the actual date. They only said this would be available soon.
Well, will people really trust Facebook to protect their dating profiles? I mean, Facebook is still trying to recover from a massive privacy scandal where data on tens of millions of users got into the hands of the firm Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's one that we should all be asking ourselves. I mean, I was kind of shaking my head about this a little bit. You know, clearly it's been in the works for a while, but many, and myself included, are wondering why they didn't delay the announcement for a little bit until they had a track record of restoring some of that trust. But, you know, it could be meant that they see this as a way to further add value to the experience so that users don't pull away. There's clearly a market for it. But it also may be that for all the controversy and the delete Facebook hashtag, very few people have dropped off. So, you know, maybe they feel like it's okay to move forward in this way.
So you don't think this is part of an effort by Facebook to change the subject from Cambridge Analytica?
Well, I mean, it might be part of an effort, but it's one that could easily backfire. I mean, having your political views bought and sold is one thing, but dating is so much more personal. So I think this kind of raises more questions than distracts away from the conversation. So, I mean, if that was in their intent, I'm not sure it's going to work.
Well, I'm struck by how shares of Match plunged yesterday after the announcement. Match, of course, is the parent company of Match.com, Tinder, OkCupid. This would seem like very bad news for these sites.
Yeah, it was interesting, and it was immediate. Well, you know, we'll have to see. For sites like Tinder, there may not be as big of an impact. I mean, their demographic is very young. It may not cross over. And by the way, one of my favorite headlines from this was from James Temperton at Wired, who wrote, "Facebook's dating isn't after Tinder. It's out to get 50-somethings lucky." Although lucky wasn't the exact word he used. But we get the point. It's sort of skewed at an older demographic, which may be why Match it has to be more worried. And by the way, a lot of the reaction was, oh, we welcome Facebook. This is, you know, a validation of the global opportunity in this marketplace. Hold on a second. It's going to get more cutthroat because Joey Levin, the CEO of Match, of IAC rather, who's Match's parent company, said, come on in, the water's warm. Their product would be great for U.S.-Russia relations. So expect this to get nasty.
Maggie Lake, CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Whatever you thought of the classic 80s film The Karate Kid, clips from that film have racked up hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube, which is one reason why today YouTube is debuting an original series that continues the movie story. It's called Cobra Kai. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans visited the set in Atlanta.
Ready and action! Welcome, everyone, to the 50th annual... No, that's not it. It wasn't.
It's a crisp, overcast December afternoon in an Atlanta gymnasium tricked out to look like the stage for a karate tournament in sunny Southern California. I can't reveal exactly why the tournament is so important, spoilers after all, but it is one of the major scenes in Cobra Kai. In his trailer nearby, star Ralph Macchio, who still looks about 15 years younger than his real age at 56, seems pleased and a little surprised to be here, because this isn't the first time someone's asked him to help create a new version of The Karate Kid.
I can't tell you the amount of times I've said no over the past 30 years. Everyone always has what they think is the greatest pitch to go back to the well again. My theory is, unless it was worthy of revisiting, let the legacy stand on its own.
The original 1984 film and its next two sequels featured Macchio as Danny LaRusso, a kid with a single mom who moved to California, got bullied, and was mentored by a kindly karate teacher played by the late Pat Morita. So what convinced Macchio to pick up his iconic headband again 34 years later? This time, it's about the bully.
When I look around this dojo, I don't see Cobra Kai material. I see losers, I see nerds.
Johnny Lawrence, the violent jerk who Danny defeated in the movie, is back to revive his old karate school, and he's played by Macchio's old co-star, William Zabka. John Hurwitz, one of the series' executive producers, says that story twist helped convince Macchio they were onto something unique.
We weren't coming to him and saying, hey, let's do The Karate Man now. Instead, we came in, flipped the script a little bit, and see Daniel LaRusso through a different set of eyes.
In Cobra Kai, Johnny is humanized. He's a loser, drinking heavily, and he's haunted by the way he was bullied by his former karate coach, or sensei, a man named John Kreese. Danny, now a successful owner of luxury car dealerships, cannot tolerate Johnny restarting his old abusive school.
I just don't know why you'd ever want to bring back Cobra Kai after what your sensei did to you.
Because I'm not Kreese. And the lessons worked.
Strike first, no mercy, real good lessons. If you think I'm going to let you fill these kids' heads with that garbage, you're nuts, man.
It is fan fiction. It really is. A great rivalry ensues, humor ensues, just based on these two guys at this age that still won't let go. And a lot of heart and soul underneath it all.
Cobra Kai was created by John Hurwitz and fellow executive producers Hayden Schlossberg and Josh Heald. Hurwitz and Schlossberg also created the Harold and Kumar film franchise. Heald wrote the Hot Tub Time Machine movie. And even though they might have a reputation for more in-your-face comedy, Schlossberg says they're serious Karate Kid fans who wanted to explore something deeper.
Part of what you learn is what makes a bad guy, you know, what makes a bully. You know, the theme of bullying, which is one of the main themes of the original Karate Kid, is that much more resonant today. And we liked the idea of exploring that theme by looking at it from one of the most iconic bullies in movie history's perspective.
Suzanne Daniels, global head of original programming for YouTube, says they develop new series based around films like Karate Kid and Step Up because their users already watch a lot of the videos connected to those franchises.
We have data that we can track on YouTube, search data, etc., watch time, and we know these are arenas and stories that they're interested in knowing more about.
Macchio says YouTube was looking to make an impact with their show.
I think they're looking for their house of cards. They're looking for something to to say they've arrived at the party in a franchise television.
The Karate Kid movie featured Danny's bond with Pat Morita's Mr. Miyagi, who taught him karate moves through chores like waxing cars, creating a classic catchphrase.
Wax on, right hand. Wax off, left hand. Wax on, wax off.
But the TV show has no new Mr. Miyagi or any other Asian actor in such a pivotal role. Macchio said the new show's diversity comes from the younger characters, high school students who wind up studying at Cobra Kai. The new show also refers often to Miyagi's memory and teachings, a connection to the old films that's important to Macchio, who sees himself as a steward of the franchise's legacy. That legacy enters a new chapter in Cobra Kai, which expands the story of the Karate Kid from a simple fight against bullying to the story of how people become bullies in the first place. I'm Eric Deggans.
Airport lounges, quiet spaces where you can relax, get free food and a drink before a long flight. Your business or first-class ticket or your credit card will get you in the door, you and, as it turns out, a lot of people. So is it worth it to pay the higher fees for the privilege of a crowded lounge? Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly, joins us. And Seth, how has the environment in these airport lounges changed?
Well, there are a lot more people in them these days. It used to be kind of a select group of travelers, maybe people who were flying on business or first class tickets, or people who at least flew very frequently, had a certain status with the airline, and got to use the lounge on certain itineraries. And now it's become a lot more democratized. Yeah, good news that more people can access them, but they have become quite a bit more crowded.
Are people waiting longer, say, to get their drinks, or?
Yeah, it's like anything where even getting a seat sometimes can be hard. This after credit cards that have granted lounge access. Used to be if you didn't have either, as I said, a business or first class ticket or some kind of status with the airline, to buy membership, it would cost you maybe $400 or $500 a year. Now, you can pay about that much in annual fees for one of these credit cards, but then they give you all these extra perks. So the effective cost of the lounge membership isn't all that much at all. No surprise, then, that those cards have become popular and the lounges have become crowded.
Why is it so popular with travelers?
Well, everybody, I think, has that aspiration to be special in some way, right? You're on board the flight, you see that curtain, you'd like to be sitting in front of it. Yeah, kind of to say when you're walking by one of those lounges and you kind of peer inside and you want to be in there, and people think, well, what does it take to get in there?
And do you know if these perks are pretty low cost for credit card companies to offer?
Well, it's low enough that they make money doing this. There are different kinds of schemes. In some cases, they might have their own lounges where, they invest the money, but then it's their lounge to grant access to as many people as they want. In other cases, they might be paying somebody else, the owner of another lounge. But, when they're doing the math, they're finding that whatever they're spending for that, they're making more of it back between the annual fees and then that percentage that they take, 2 or 3% of every transaction every time you purchase something with that card.
Is it worth then paying a high annual fee to get access to an airport lounge, in your opinion?
If you travel a whole lot, it might become worth it, especially if you take advantage of, the food and drinks in the lounge where it saves you from spending some money in the airport. On the other hand, people who travel very frequently sometimes are able to get lounge access in other ways. For example, by flying a lot with the airline and having status in that airline's frequent flyer program. Sometimes, if you're flying on an international itinerary, even in economy class, if you're, a gold or a platinum member with that airline because of how much you fly, you might be able to use the lounge for free. So, yeah, the math just kind of depends. But clearly, a good number of people are finding it worth it.
I can see people having very little sympathy for this situation, so you have to wait in line a little longer for a drink, or your food options are snacks instead of entrees, and it's more crowded in there. Big deal.
I think if you talk to people about how they feel, you're almost going to get a different answer depending on whether, you're talking to somebody who's been using these lounges for decades and feels like the experience has only gotten worse, as opposed to somebody who's only been using them for the past year or two, somebody who's the problem in the eyes of that other person, and who says, hey, you know, this is better than being outside the lounge.
So, Seth, since you travel a lot, for the rest of us who don't have airport lounge access, what's the best strategy for finding a quiet space in a busy airport?
These days, it might be outside the lounge. In a restaurant, for example, you know, where, yeah, you have your own table. Sure, you have to buy the food and drinks, but it can actually be a more relaxed atmosphere sometimes now than the lounges themselves. And depending on how often you travel, you know, what you spend in the restaurant might not add up as much as the lounge membership costs.
Seth Kaplan is managing partner at the industry publication Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mina.
It may be hard to recall now, but it was just 9 months ago that ISIS was defeated in its stronghold in Iraq, Mosul. Today, teams of volunteers are still recovering bodies of ISIS fighters and civilians who were often used as shields by the militants, and both ISIS and civilians killed in airstrikes carried out by the U.S., the U.K., and other coalition countries supporting the Iraqi forces doing the house-to-house fighting on the ground. There's no hard estimate on the number of civilians killed, but one places it as high as 10,000. BBC defense correspondent Jonathan Beal went to Mosul recently. He joins us now. And Jonathan, we're going to link listeners to your reporting on the ground in Mosul. It's incredible. It looks like an ancient city ravaged by an earthquake. Describe what you saw.
Yeah, I think it's a tale of two cities in the sense that if you look at East Mosul, life is returning to normal. You can see people carrying out repairs on their homes. Restaurants are open. It is a buzzing city as we speak. But if you go to the west, to the old city, which was the heavily populated area, it is utter devastation. It looks like a scene from Stalingrad in the Second World War. And still in that area, they are pulling out bodies. A lot of them, as you say, IS fighters, maybe their families too, but clearly civilians still trapped under the rubble. And the cleanup operation hasn't really started there. So it is a very different picture in the old city to what you see in East Mosul, which has life returning to normal.
Well, you met these volunteer groups that are working their way through. They've got, you know, protective clothing on and gloves and masks, and they are one after the other pulling bodies out of rubble. They're all volunteer, and one of them is named Shura al-Husseini. Here she speaks through an interpreter.
There are a lot of victims from the airstrikes, and a lot of them are still buried under the rubble. We cannot pull them out with our bare hands.
Jonathan Beal, tell us more about these people. You know, who are they and why are they doing this gruesome work, you know, as volunteers?
Simply because they say nobody else is doing the job. And, you know, as summer approaches, they fear about disease. A lot of these IS bodies have just been left to rot in the heat. So they're the ones that are on the surface, the ones that they can see. One room we went to had 100 bodies in, or the remains of 100 bodies, including women and children. Some signs, some of them had been shot. In another room, there were about 30 they were pulling out, and all around them are still the unexploded devices that IS use, suicide belts, for example, grenades. It is a toxic wasteland, the old city still, not just bombs, but bodies too. And these volunteers are doing this work, and they were all young. They'd all connected on social media, were doing it because nobody else was. So it shows that nobody really has been counting the bodies. Nobody knows how many civilians have been killed in this battle or whether they've been killed at the hands of IS, and no doubt many did die at the hands of IS being used as human shields, or as a result of coalition airstrikes. And as you heard, Sroor, whose name, as it happens, means happiness, but it's not a happy task that she's doing. She was saying that you know, they could not lift all the boulders to find all those people who might still be trapped underneath, although we know that the Iraqi authorities have gone to areas where family members have alerted to them to a place where they have lost loved ones.
Well, you mentioned the Iraqi authorities. Why aren't they doing this clearing out? And what does your government there, the UK, say about your reporting and this revelation of how many civilians might have been killed?
One reason is that They're IS fighters. There are some people who believe just let them rot, but also because the scale of the task. As far as the UK government, now, we went there because the UK government has held this line that it's seen no evidence of causing any civilian casualties in British airstrikes. Remember, Britain, second only to the US in the number of airstrikes carried out against IS targets, hit more than 750 targets in the city RAF jets, yet they still have this line, we've seen no evidence of causing civilian casualties. A source inside the coalition has told us that he believes that he's seen evidence that RAF airstrikes have caused civilian casualties. We couldn't find conclusive proof, but there's certainly plenty of people in the old city who are angry about the coalition airstrikes, even though they hated IS. Mm. Interestingly, today, the Ministry of Defence in London have changed their line. So in the last 24 hours, they were saying no evidence of any civilian casualties today. They have admitted to their first civilian casualty. This was in Syria, not in Mosul. And this was because they were looking at video imagery from a drone and they saw a motorbike rider coming in to their target area when they were trying to take out IS fighters in a vehicle. He was unintentionally killed. But they've had nobody on the ground. And to be honest, the US has done it once. They haven't properly, fully investigated the effects of those coalition airstrikes.
I hope your pictures are widely disseminated. That's BBC defense correspondent Jonathan Beale. We'll post your reporting at hereandnow.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Mina Kim. This is Here and Now.